Welcome to Cut the Bull, an insightful podcast which addresses the news of the day and the cultural issues plaguing our society, bringing logic and context to these topics and discussing solutions too real for mainstream pundits. Now, here are your hosts, Charles Love and Wilfred Riley.
Hello and welcome to Cut the Bull. I am Charles Love alongside my co-host Wilfred Riley. And our guest this week is a special one. We are joined by Bob Woodson, founder of the Woodson Center. You know, our very illustrious leader at 1776 Unites and Voices of Black Mothers. Bob, welcome to the show.
Pleased to be here to join you.
It's good to have you. Obviously, we're going to talk about a lot of things. I'm going to do something different this time, though. I think I want to start with a positive. We did an episode a few months ago with a group of women, and you know, there's a lot of gender stuff going on, and they always talking about we need to elevate women, we need to train women, we need to focus on women. Female, the future is female. And I asked if things were really as bad for women as the media is saying it is. So I kind of want to start there as we talk about Black America and what's going on. Obviously, there are problems, but I think we kind of exaggerate these problems. So Bob, are things a little bit better than we make them out to be? I mean, the discussions about how Black life is so, you know, bad, negative struggles, which do exist, but is that, you know, what you see across all of Black America?
Yes. Well, first of all, let me just say that I think we make a mistake when we generalize about any group, mm-hmm. particularly women, to say that all women share the same challenges, and therefore there's a single remedy for all women. Whenever you approach that with that understanding, the consequence is when you try to intervene, the benefits always help those at the top at the expense of those at the bottom. Let's just take the Me Too movement. It was really started by a young Black mother in Harlem who wanted to bring together her friends who were single moms to share strategies for addressing abuse. Middle-class women got hold of it. Suddenly it became the trauma confronting middle and upper-class actresses on Harvey Weinstein's casting couch. And so then you have the Cosby situation come. And so that suddenly the focus is on the abuse of these women. Mm-hmm. And so then the talks and then the charges that are filed and whatnot. And so what were some of the remedies? All right, more women need to be on boards of directors. More women should be hired in firms. All of these so-called opportunities that were being presented help those who are well-educated or well-situated or celebrities. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting during that same period of time, Geraldo Rivera from Fox did a 2-hour special on the sexual assault of women in prisons. Every one of the victims was Black. Every one of the victimizers was Black. It did not generate a single response from the public or the media. And the women's pleas to have just an 800 number phone in the prison so that if an assault occurs, they could call someone for help. None of these were even discussed. And so they were ignored. So when you, what about these women? And so again, when you generalize, tell me how a well-educated Black woman with a law degree suddenly gets a higher paying job. What the hell has that got to do with a Black woman in a prison being assaulted daily by her Black victimizer?
Right.
So if we continue to look at life through the prism of race, when evil wears a Black face, evil never gets confronted. So that's a class situation. So you can never ever generalize and say, oh, this is going to help women. No, it's going to help upper income women at the expense of lower income women.
Gotta love it. Will, do you want? I don't even have a question, just a comment about that, which is so logical but rarely said.
I agree with Bob. Obviously, it's why we brought the OG on, you know. But I mean, in all seriousness, though, that's something that's been said. Tom Sowell, I mean, is another person who's noted this for a while, that in America there's a real taboo about talking about social class because we don't have social classes in America, that overrides even talking about race and gender. And race is often used as a proxy for social class, in fact. So what you'll do is you'll have these policies that say, well, we're going to help the disadvantaged. This was just outlined very well. But this is the thing with affirmative action. We're going to help the disadvantaged, meaning Blacks, people of Spanish descent, Hispanics, so on down the line. So there's a program that you're not supposed to do it this way anymore. But for every 100 seats in a medical or law school, you're going to have 20 Blacks and 10 Hispanics. The problem with this is that the Black and Hispanic kids that go into that program are going to be the best Black and Hispanic kids in the pool, who are only going to be about 80, maybe SAT points behind the best white kids, and who just would have gone to different law schools and medical schools if it hadn't been for the program. So there's really no class difference. This is important, between a Black kid that goes to Harvard and a white kid that goes to Harvard. There was Skip Gates, Henry Louis Gates, actually looked at this a while ago. And it was one of those things, like the classic definition of a gaffe is when you slip and tell the truth, because he's a classic man of the left. But he found out that the huge majority of the Black people at Harvard were either biracial, like well-off Jewish American dad, that kind of thing. Nothing wrong with that. But they were literal foreign lords. They were from like Nigeria, the Caribbean, so on. Or they were just rich, like they were Robert Johnson's kids. There were almost no working class, native-born Black Americans on the campus. And he honestly kept these results quiet for a little bit. But I mean, eventually it was something that became discussed in the Black middle class. We've all heard it. Yeah. So, I mean, the question is, how do you get around that? And I mean, the answer is you either treat people as people, which is my suggestion, or you at least start talking about broad categories like region, class, that make a little more sense. I mean, Appalachia is more integrated than you might think in everyone's poor. So a program to help working men in Appalachia would at least make sense, whereas a program to help veterans would be another good group. Whereas a program to help Hispanic people doesn't mean anything. That's not really even a category. I mean, that would include Black Puerto Ricans and white Chileans and so on down the line.
Right. And that's it. Oh, go ahead, Bob. What were you going to ask?
I made the case in a recent column that I wrote on affirmative action for the Messenger, when I detail how affirmative action had lethal consequences for poor Blacks in Los Angeles. Following the Watts riot, a hospital was established by the medical community that had 500 beds, 2,000 employees, and it was a teaching hospital. And it was really providing first-class medical assistance to the Black community in Watts. And along come the social justice warriors and say, well, the staff should reflect the ethnic and racial makeup of the population that they serve. All of a sudden, decisions are being made. Competent whites were fired from heading offices. Doctors and nurses were hired based upon race and not upon competence. And as a consequence, the quality of medical care for the people of Watts dramatically declined to the point where they lost certification. And in fact, the people in the community used to call the Martin Luther King Hospital Killer King because of the number of low-income Blacks who were dying in that hospital. But again, no one writes about that. So we are supposed to sacrifice the quality of care for low-income Blacks to satisfy the racial demands of the middle and upper class, whether they're competent or not.
Right.
But we don't talk about that. I never hear that reported.
Right. And isn't that, I mean, kind of the two biggest problems, if you truly plan to make things better for people who are struggling? We started with the one overgeneralization, if you're thinking that everybody in a particular group is struggling, you know, I liken it to if you want to solve a problem, how big you think the problem is would dictate how you approach it, right? So if you say, we got a few kids who need a little reading assistance, you set up some tutors and you have some people help them read. If you say every kid can't read, of course you want to change the whole system. So if you enter it thinking that all Blacks are in the same, you know, terrible situation. I know at the beginning of, you know, right after George Floyd died, when everybody was kind of, you know, spiraling and trying to grasp at straws and think of what they should do next, I saw constant media conversations, social media, you know, in business talking about how they want to help. And they sounded caring. But I sat back and I listened to what they were saying. And I realized, you think Black life is equal to poverty, interactions with the police, and illegitimate households and illiteracy. That's what they think Black life is. So of course, these social justice warriors are walking around thinking that Black life is so bad. Not only is Black life so bad, if you add, they would have asked a Black person and assumed the answer would be, don't you hate being Black? That they would say yes. Yet you can see Black people always talking about how proud they are of being Black, but they just thought Black life was so bad. So they needed to fix, not the problems, they needed to fix Black life, right? That's one of the problems, the generalization. But the other is, you know, who gets the help? Like you both were saying, even if you implement a program to solve the problem, you never try to look at what's causing the problem. You just say, there is a problem, let's throw money at it, let's throw time, let's talk about racism. And in the last couple of years, correct me if I'm wrong, Bob, but the only thing that's been on the board has been racism. So they get the whiteboard and say, list all of the problems that could cause, you know, obesity, diabetes at young age, that could cause poverty, you know, low job skills. And they write racism and they put the chalk down. So they don't even consider that there may be other things. So if you don't consider it, you can't even, you know, think about a solution for them, right?
I spend a lot of my time working on behalf of and in low-income Black and brown neighborhoods. And I can tell you, in all of the gatherings that I do, I never hear racism coming up as the principal barrier, nor is it a solution to overcoming brokenness in their lives. They talk about what we must do to be agents of our own uplift. They also don't believe that deprivation leads to for you to be depraved just because you're... Just because you may be, you know, in need, it doesn't mean that you're depraved. Just because, but again, it's really a bait and switch game where middle class Blacks use the demographics of low income Blacks as the bait, and when the remedy arrives and the money is dispensed, it goes to the middle class, who devote solutions. They parachute solutions into those communities designed by them. And so the question for them isn't which problem is solvable, but which one is fundable.
Mm-hmm. Right, so right.
We have created a commodity out of low-income people.
Right, right. So Will.
And so it doesn't matter how sympathetic you are or how compassionate. If you work in an institution that is structurally designed to repress people, it doesn't matter what the sex or race of the ruler. Mm-hmm. And that's what our current anti-poverty efforts are like.
If he's working for decades with people who are in difficult situations and they understand they need to make a change, they need to fix their situation, how is it that those of us who are far more educated and are supposedly trying to help don't get it? I mean, we get maligned for saying that you play a part in how your life will end up and what the decisions you make.
Well, I think that the class divide here or the social divide here plays a really big role. Like, I think that all of those sort of post-Marxist ideas that we all spend a lot of time poking fun at are kind of an infestation of the American upper middle class. Like, all of us grew up in working class neighborhoods and no one believes this stuff. I still remember that one of the biggest arguments I ever got into on Twitter was when I said that men are in general attracted to pretty, sometimes younger women. I mean, obviously, like, old enough to drink and so on. And women are attracted to men who have money, generally, all else being equal. And all these people started responding hysterically, like, no, that's anti-feminist rhetoric. You need to read Simone de Beauvoir's second book and all this. And I think that there's a great deal of blank slate bullshit that's been fed into a certain chunk of society. And at root, the core idea behind all of this is, how to phrase it, like, all humans across all racial groups, across men and women, are exactly potentially equal. So any failure, then this would be true in genetic terms, this would be true in cultural terms, so on down the line. So any failure that anyone experiences is someone else's fault. So when people that have been trained in kind of upper middle class rhetorical tools go to the hood, what they see is racism. Like, there's an incident of redlining 50 years ago that must have caused this or something like this. And I think if any of us went back to, for me, and this isn't even a black neighborhood, but like Bridgeport in Chicago, Gary, Indiana, you know, the East Coast, the great East Coastal cities, I think Philly, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, if you go back there, you go back to one of these working class neighborhoods, you notice a lot of stuff. Like, people are having babies at 17 without dad around. That's obviously a choice that you can decide not to make. I mean, you don't even have to be abstinent. You just condoms, oral sex. You can do a bunch of different things. Like, people, there's a great deal of gang culture in these neighborhoods that's self-selected within the community. So on down the line. So I think ordinary citizens, when they look at this stuff, can see that there are obvious problems that could be solved. Like, how do you break the gangs? This is the first question Bukele says he asked as president of El Salvador. How do you stop kids from having sex at ages that are too young? How do you do any of this stuff? How do you teach people to read? You know, and if you're coming from outside that paradigm, I'm kind of rambling here, but if you're coming from the middle class, like, educational paradigm, your question is going to be different. It's going to be, how can we eliminate the outside problem that must be causing this? And can I get paid to do that? And that secondary question is useless. But you're really seeing a very sharp divide. And when you watch people from a poor white community like my own in Appalachia, or a black community, talk to, for example, sociologists, it's like watching Martians talk to earthlings. Like, you'll hear someone say, don't you understand that the root of your problem is late labor capitalism? And like the redneck guy with the 3-foot red hair will be saying, like, well, the root of the problem is the plant left. Couldn't we just pass some kind of law says a plant can't leave? I mean, so it's just a total non-comprehension. And I'm with the guy from Kentucky on that one.
Right, right.
What you were saying is so funny. In terms of how race is used to exempt leaders from personal responsibility, there was a trio of shoplifters operating in a shopping center. Upscale shopping center. One was a black guy dressed in a warm-up suit with a hoodie, and a well-dressed white couple. The black guy would go in and go around expensive goods and act suspiciously, and he would draw all the security. And the well-dressed white couple would go behind security and do all the stealing. And then the three of them were meet in the parking lot to divide up the goods.
Coming from an integrated working class Chicago neighborhood, like, every one of the best thieves I've ever known was a pretty middle class looking white girl. Like, it's not even close. Like, every single one of them. Like, they would do things like walk into Macy's or Gimbel's, try on a bracelet, and then just, like, incidentally saunter over to another display. And I suppose I don't approve of public theft, but at the time, in high school or college, everyone thought this was pretty funny. But it was a known fact. Like, a black or even a white man in a trap suit would be followed around the store by suspicious-looking security guards asking him if they could help every two steps. And meanwhile, the actual thieves would just be cleaning the place out.
See?
But if you were a kid from one of the cities, you knew who the thieves were. Like, you'd walk through and, like, wave at them. Like, I see what's going on. You know, so that sort of thing, again, there's a huge disconnect between the kind of people that I think of as being from Naperville, the Chicago suburb, or from Scarsdale, who've kind of read about reality, and people that actually grew up in reality, whether this is the hood, military, whatever, when it comes to understanding some of this stuff. Like, It's not true that the thief is always the black guy. It's also
Okay,
true
but
that
they,
there are people who know who a thief is.
But they pander to that stereotype. They exploit it.
Right.
You know.
Right. So they use it.
So for the black guys, like, if you are going to steal, don't wear like your NBA jacket and go to the store. I mean, like, there are a lot
don't
of
go
reasons
giving
why
theft
black people
tips,
are more
Will.
likely to get arrested.
Don't let them know that if they dress up, they might get away with it. But what about the people who
I'd rather
disagree
not
with
get
us?
arrested if you're getting to grow out of it and whatever.
But what about the people who disagree with us will say, ha, that's a perfect example of the rampant racism we deal with every day. The black man can't shop in a tracksuit. So that proves that the whole of the country is racism. What do you say to that response?
Well, I say that if all white people went to Canada and Europe tomorrow, the question is, what problem would that solve? How would that affect the black on black violence? How would that affect the out of wedlock births? How would that affect the unemployment rate? In other words, I make people confront realities when they come challenging me. I say that I know 10 people who were violent predators last year, and now they're ambassadors of peace. Or I knew people who were drug addicted last year, and now they're free. And I can explain to you how they made that transformation. Show me yours.
Right.
Show me how blaming white folks for their misbehavior. Tell me how, if white people change, what change would it inspire in the people suffering the problem?
Right. That,
see,
right.
If you believe that that's where the solutions are, then you are a white supremacist. If you believe that white people, as I said, I was debating Hawk Newman, Black Lives Matter New York.
Right.
You can see it on YouTube for an hour. I said, Hawk, man, black folks have been running these cities for 50 years, and they're running school systems, the prosecutor's office, the police, hospitals, foster care systems. Tell me why black, low-income blacks are failing in systems run by their own people. If racism, and why aren't all blacks suffering equally?
Right.
The biggest income gap is not between whites and blacks, it's upper income blacks and lower income blacks.
Right.
If
and they're living in the same
were
country.
The same country in the same city.
Right.
So right in the same city, you see these disparities within the black community. And my point is, if racism were the sole culprit, all blacks should be suffering equally.
Right. Isn't the problem?
I don't want to be compared to whites. I want to be compared to a black Nigerian, because they make more money than whites do, man.
Right.
They have better education, better jobs, more property, more wealth. Yes, compare me to a Nigerian, man. They're not in jail.
Right. Well, to solve that problem, you know, you talk about what we hear. I'm in the thick of it, so I get attacked on these all the time. I was telling you earlier about the town hall I was at. And so a woman challenged me in the Q&A portion, black woman. And she said that, well, the studies show, and I already knew I was in trouble, studies show that children of African descent, and I say African descent because black can come into different kinds of cultures, so she kind of argued against her own point, learn better. The studies show that they learn better and they do better and they flourish with culturally responsive teaching. So if you give them, you know, characters in the book that look like them and the names and the word problems were something they could relate to, then they learn better. So what are you doing in this district to implement that? So obviously I had several problems with it. Like, one, how did myself and people older than me and Bob Woodson and others get educated if we sat around waiting for them to teach us the way we understood it? But beyond that, they're forgetting that there's a difference between giving a kid something that he likes, so he has interest in reading, and something he can quote unquote relate to. Because the problem is those same people that we're talking about are the teachers. So they're going to assume that we can relate to whatever they think of as black life, right? So you never get your mind open. You never hear about, sometimes you want to hear about what happened in a different world in a different time. That's part of broadening your mind. Or you never find out that the classics for hundreds of years have been writing about the human condition. So you learn that as bad as you may have it, a lot of these things have been happening a long time across cultures. You don't know that if you do that. But she's saying that we need certain, it's not that blacks can't learn. They just need to be taught in a way that that's different because blacks are different, which, and this was a black woman. And the problem, and this is what I get on a regular basis on the school board, constant, mostly just she was black, but mostly white liberals saying, we need more blacks in this school because this school doesn't have enough blacks. But we're supposed to ignore the fact that the district is 7% black. Where are you going to get the blacks from? Right? You're in a district that's affluent or whatever the case may be. And they say, well, bust them in. So now we're going back to Boston, you know, circa 1960, and we're going to move people around the city so we can have the right mix of black kids in the school. And no one's addressing the actual problem. And well, lastly, by the way, in the city, we had almost a million students, almost 50% of them can't read a grade level, regardless of race.
Well, that's the point. But the point that I make in response to people like that, I bring out the studies that show that Walter Williams pointed out, that in those five black high schools at the turn of the century in New York, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, and New Orleans, used textbooks, crumbling buildings, half the budget of white schools, and yet every one of those schools out-tested every white school in 1925. How did they do that? Using used textbooks, half the budgets. If they were able to achieve in the face of segregation and not only competed but outperform white schools, why can't we do it today?
So what are we doing different now then? Why aren't we outperforming them?
It is the values that the parents and the people bring to their educational experience that determines. We had 85% of children being raised in parents. I was raised in a low-income, black, segregated neighborhood where 90% of the households had a man and a woman raising children. I went to an all-black school. They had third grade plays at night so parents could attend. And on the back table were lunch pails of people who put their room, and it was safe. All of the stores were black. They didn't have any fence around their stores. Never heard of any of these stores being robbed. Elderly people could walk without fear of being assaulted by their grandchildren. Never heard of a gunfire, never heard of a child shot in a crib. So how were we able to maintain peace in our community if in living in the midst of de jure segregation? Mm-hmm. Then tell me why we have just the opposite at a time when we are running those institutions.
Wow. Will, isn't it, as positive as that is, isn't there a problem in the sense that you listen to that and you say, that's good on the racism side, that's gotten better. And even when there was open racism, they were able to achieve. But now the problem seems to be things we can't really control. So from that standpoint, doesn't that make it a little more difficult?
I mean, I'm not sure you can control the hate in people's hearts either. That's actually an interesting
question. Right, but the system, you can't change the curriculum in education and think, all right, now the parents are going to pay attention, right?
Well, I mean, I think you can change the things that cause some of these problems. Like the transition away from two-parent families followed the Great Society welfare system almost step by step. Right. So, I mean, like, you can work with those programs. I mean, you know, is there some workfare incentive where you have to seek jobs in order to get any kind of benefit from the government? I think pretty much all of us on the right would support that. You know, is there, we have all kind of marriage tax penalties right now. I mean, oh, there are only two major ones, but is there some kind of reward that you, bluntly, is there some kind of reward you can give married or smart people for having kids? I mean, they're doing this in Hungary. Like, you could really do almost anything to incentivize healthy behavior.
And we know that's true because they're incentivizing the bad behavior right now. Yes, and they're getting more of that.
If you're looking around the world, like right now in America, we seem to have this weird morality, which is almost conventional morality turned on its head, which is that you can't enforce social order and dignity if it could theoretically hurt anyone. So you see this crazy shit, like Texas is actually enforcing the border in front of their state with the nation of Mexico. And it's being described as like the use of razor wire to kill children. That's just what having a border fence is. Like, thousands of people are kept out, thousands of crimes are prevented. Some of the people that would get through, of course, would be nice people as well. But I mean, like, one person every couple of months gets hurt. That's just a border. It's a fence around your country. I mean, you know, Israel was recently attacked by a Hamas terrorist group based in Palestine, where 1,400 people were killed or raped, and they responded with a war, because that's what's called a casus belli, a declaration of war. And now the war is being described as sort of this unprovoked murder of small children. And when we see this all over, like COVID-19, no one could go outside because theoretically one grandmother who hadn't been given an N95 mask could die. That's not a sustainable policy platform for a society.
Right.
And it's the same thing with welfare. Like, if you mentioned cutting these programs, the response, and Bob's probably heard this far more than us during the 80s and 90s policy battles, do you want children starving in the street? And the answer is there would be far fewer abused children if you stopped incentivizing programs that allow mothers to raise kids without a father around and to have an infinite number of kids into these situations. And if you look around the world as a political scientist, and this is serious research at this point, I mean, there are countries that are doing things that we tend to freak out about and describe as evil and eugenic, but a Viktor Orban in Hungary is actually paying stable, drug-free married women to have kids. He thinks it's a good idea. He'll get more Hungarians that way without mass immigration. The rising African nations like Nigeria and Kenya are thinking about linking welfare benefits to what's called Norplant, like a contraceptive, basically. So while you are on welfare, as soon as you're off, you can do whatever you want. But while you're on the dole, you can't have kids that you can't support. So, I mean, there actually are a ton of ways to regulate human behavior that we could do. I don't see why we wouldn't explore some of this stuff. The answer is just that there would be mass hysterics. And again, that group of like up middle class, kind of indoctrinated Americans, if you propose this. But if you ask the average person, like a Black or Irish or Italian American lady sitting on a porch, like, should you be able to have 9 kids you can't support? The answer would be no, hell no. What are you talking about? So again, there's that contrast between what everyone sort of knows and what you're allowed to publicly say, and that's a real social problem.
Bob,
and also the glorification of some of these rappers. I think his name is Cannon, has 12 kids by 6 different women, and another one, he's 23 years old, and he has 5 women pregnant at the same time, and they're going to have a joint baby shower.
I haven't heard
that
second.
That's some sick shit, man.
Yeah.
Let's see this. Who's this guy?
But yeah, but no one could stand up and say, now, you know, I mean, that's some sick stuff.
But that's funny. To what Will was saying about incentive, that's important. I want to go there for a bit. And what you just said about what the rapper and the others doing, because I constantly say what I say every other episode.
Wait, Charles, this is one of your guys. This is New York City drill rapper Zeddy Will. I wasn't sure whether or not this was a joke. Sorry about that.
That's the one with the 5 pregnant at the same time.
And what may be called a startling achievement, New York City drill artist Zeddy Will made his 5 partners pregnant at almost the same time, some during 3 enforcement encounters, and is hosting a joint baby shower for his 5 pregnant baby mamas.
Yes, sir.
But that goes to my other piece. I want to talk about what Will said about incentive, but I mean, we can look at the tape. I'm guessing at least every other episode, I'm talking about shame. We need to bring shame back. You know,
exactly.
I think at one period point, it probably went too far, but the fact that we lost all shame, I used to joke about the Seinfeld episode. What someone would ask me, what really was the marker that ruined the country for you, Charles? And I would say the Seinfeld episode when someone thought George and Jerry were gay and they said, we're not gay. And then they threw their hands up and say, not that there's anything wrong with it. From that point on, that was their response to everything. Kid knocks over a liquor store. Who are we to say it's wrong? I mean, I wouldn't do it, but who am I to say? So we got rid of shame. And then Will made a point about incentives. Well, I think we have a plethora of negative incentives, right? There's this big debate. Like I talked about the school board, when it's not race, it's always LGBT. We need a resolution for this. We need new programs for this. And I'm not against anybody to do whatever they want to do, but when you incentivize something, you get more of it. So it's a difference between, you know, the 80s when you had gay bash and you say, that's wrong. People need equal rights. That's a great thing. And then overshooting it and now saying, well, we should have parades and every company should be a sponsor in it. We should have this month. We should change the movies we promote. We should put on the, when I moved to New York, there were billboards that said sex work is work, right? There, so you're promoting sex work. You paint the whole train, you know, the LGBT flag thing. So obviously the more you promote it, the more you get. So now Will can give you the stats. What is it? 146% of 13-year-old girls say that they're non-binary. It's insane. I'm not saying people aren't, but the fact that it goes up 1,000% in a year, you know, it's this social contagion, not about going as far as doing it. But of course, if you normalize stuff, people say, yeah, that's pretty good. Oh, that's cool. And that's a hip thing to do.
Well, the interesting thing
about
the,
not only normalization of the relationship, it's the normalization of the activities associated with it. I was watching a little docudrama about two gay men. I'm going to try to understand. One of the end of the episode, one guy gave the other guy AIDS, mm-hmm. and so he was sorry. He said, and his last statement to his partner is, "I'm very sorry that I wasn't more careful."
Mm-hmm. Well, Will, you were going to reply, but what?
You know, not more faithful. But I'm sorry, I was not more careful, and it ended. And I'm supposed to be sympathetic to someone who says, my only sin is that I wasn't more careful, right. Not that I was unfaithful to you.
Right.
And I said, so I'm supposed to, so part of the same-sex marriage package is infidelity is baked into it.
Right. But also the fact that you get 5% of the population and it becomes 90% of the conversation. I know they're writing this resolution. So at the next board meeting, I'm going to bring it up. I've been on this board for 7 months. When did we talk about education? Because it seems like every month we just argue about race and LGBT every month. How is that helping the kids? And then you watch TV and movies. Every episode has to have a character. But if they're 5% of the population, you ask people, I'll go to you, Will, now, but I think there was a study a couple of years that they asked regular people, what percentage of people do you think are identified as LGBTQ? And they were like 35%. They're like, it's gotta be a lot of them because it's everywhere, right? And it's like, no, it's still five.
Actually, I think that's a really important point because, I mean, when you just said you're on a school board, you're an elected official in one of, I mean, the world cities, and you guys haven't talked about education at all. Like, you haven't talked about whether to buy a, like, just think of some decisions that I'm looking at KSU right now, whether or not to adopt online classes from Magellan or something. That's not what you're talking about. You're talking about whether you're going to support a ceasefire in Palestine. I think that this gets back to what Bob asked, which is, how the hell are the schools so much worse than they were when, you know, if you saw someone of a different race, you had to fight him. Like, how have we gotten so much further back in terms of education than a more civilized era? The answer is that we're spending less time on education.
Right.
And that's measurable. Like, there are declining standards in terms of what we used to do. Like, even in physical education, if you pull up the old gym curriculum from the 1950s, it's just like, okay, scrimmage at whatever, and then you guys do 200 push-ups and you go to your next class. Like, it's there's actual physical training that goes on. And now we don't do that. It's, you know, sit down and read a book about how to eat green vegetables the last time I was in a high school. I'm not kidding at all. So it's the same thing in the mental education, right? Like, if you're, have either of you gentlemen seen the meme where the kid is like, are we going to learn algebra today? Like, eighth grade guy,
Caucasian
kid. And the teacher's like, shut up, we gay today. When they have like all these rainbow flags and crap on the wall and it's like LGBT Prominence Week or something, like that has to have an impact on education. Like, there have always been, I mean, I use the Chicago examples, African-American, Irish, Italian. There have always been working class parents who just dropped their kid off at the school and picked him up after school and after practice. That's always happened. But the idea was that when they were in the school for 10 hours a day, they were going to learn math, reading. That's it. Now, I don't think that's the case. I mean, there are a lot of classes like social studies that are very vague and sort of discuss whether America is good. And there are lots of other things like, you know, it's Black History Month right now. And obviously, we're going to talk about some great Black figures we are. But like, you know, you're spending in 30 days discussing the racism of America and so on. And that also cuts into the amount of time you have for actual active learning. So that's a big part of the piece. But last thing, the gay kids. This is an article I wrote for National Review. The weird thing about the gay kids is that they're all virgins. So
the
percentage of high school senior men that have ever had sex has dropped, and you can think this is good or bad. You guys are both good Christians, but it's dropped from like 80%, like you just meet your girl after high school, to like 30, 40. COVID probably played a role. But at the same time, the percentage of people that are saying they're into all these weird sexual kinks has increased like 500%. So yeah, like people are saying they're like bisexual and polyqueer and they're into play. And it's like, shut up, kid. You've never even kissed a boy. Right. So, but I mean, that's the contrast there. Like the majority of the people saying they're bisexual are like high school sophomore girls who have not had sexual intercourse, who say they've had one boyfriend, maybe one girlfriend. So I think that there's that weird dichotomy between like, I've seen almost everything on my phone. I think at the outer extreme, I might be mildly into this, but over here, I've never had any romantic relationships at all. So it's just associating with something that's presented as cool.
Bob, yeah. I want to give you one quick example to what Will was saying about what we actually do and how little we talk about education. And then I want to finish on actually solving problems, things you do and Black History Month. But to talk about, I say we don't talk about education. Okay, so we talk about education, but it's always through the lens of race and gender. For instance, we got into a big battle a few months ago about lottery because we had selective enrollment schools for the students who were supposed to be academically achieving at a certain level, and you had to test to get into schools. De Blasio on his way out the door said, well, that's not fair because there's not enough Black people. There's no diversity. We need to desegregate the schools. Side note, they were majority Asian, but we need to desegregate these schools and get some more Black kids in them, which great. Black kids in these schools, great. But to do it, they can't pass the test. Come on, they're Black. Of course they can't pass the test. So what we're going to do is we're going to eliminate that and we're going to implement a lottery. So at the meeting, they're all debating, and I asked the question, I'm a little naive, I'm new here. How exactly is a lottery going to guarantee more Black kids? It's a lottery, right? So unless you're cheating, right? The population of District 2 is only 7% Black. There's only so many balls in the lottery, right? So that's the first thing. So we talk about it from that standpoint. Is it fair that there's not enough Black kids at the selective enrollment schools? And to which I reply, let's have more, but let's do it by not scrapping the test, but improving the academics at the elementary school so they can pass get it. Shut up, racist. That's what they did. They told me they needed to educate me on segregation and integration because I didn't know. That was the response. So that was one debate. And another was about, you know, I guess now the LGBTQ thing, but before that it was, you mentioned Palestine, that was really on there, but also zone schools, right? Should people be able to go to any school so they get to, so they're not going to the school in the neighborhood, but at least they can go to the better schools. But now you got, you know, 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds starting middle school, taking trains all over the city, you know, just so they can go to different schools. But none of this is improving the fact that K-3 across the city, you have 48 to 51% of the kids reading at grade level. So nothing that we're discussing is fixing that. We're discussing, again, like Bob's at the margins, how do we help upper middle class kids, but say we're helping poor kids. That's all we're doing. Nobody who's failing is getting helped by anything we're talking about.
But I think we need to talk about solutions.
Yes.
Some of the solutions that we have come up, and that's why it's important in our essays that we talk about how the Golden 13 were able to achieve. Those are 13, in 1943, you know, there were no Black naval officers.
The first officers, yes. Mm-hmm.
No Black naval officers. And Roosevelt persuaded husband to train 16 Black men with college degrees as naval officers, but the Navy decided to give them in 8 weeks that which they give white cadets in 16 weeks, knowing that they would wash out. When they found out about it, they covered the windows in their barracks and stayed up and studied all night. And when they tested them, they scored in the 90th percentile, all of them. They said they cheated, so they retested them individually. They scored in the 93rd percentile. They allowed 13 to become naval officers. That test score remains the highest ever achieved in any graduating class to this day from the Naval Academy. And there are other examples like that, the five high schools. Why don't we study the success and resilience of these men to find out what is it that they did that enabled them to achieve against the odds? There was maybe 10 or 12 years ago, the University of Georgia had a math, had a program for black kids where they would, you know, affirmative action so that they could take extra work. Well, a young black man came in who was a mathematician and took these kids who were failing and drilled them. He set up what he called a math boot camp. And he drilled these kids on mathematics every day. And he made it enjoyable for them and motivated them. After a while, these kids who were all from deprived neighborhoods began to score A's and B's in math. And so when they were entered into the regular curriculum, they excelled. He was so successful that white kids were asking to be admitted to his program. Hmm. So the answer is not to lower the standards. It's to provide special help to so that we teach our children the way with one the model of the Golden 13. And that is to expect excellence and teach excellence. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the answers to it.
Right.
And go in and find. And so kids are motivated when they have victories that are possible. That's why in our essays, we try to go back from the past and try to introduce our young people to victories that were achieved under the worst of conditions.
Right. Isn't that part of the problem, though? I mean, while silly people debate about the importance of and debate about whether we should have a Black History Month, the real problem with it isn't that we have it. It's the fact that too many people focus on the negative. They say, hey, look at Harriet Tubman. Hey, look at this. Look at what systemic racism does and how they do it today. I've had two companies at the first of the month that I know that sent emails on February 1st. As we celebrate Black history, let's talk about, have a panel on systemic racism, on environmental racism, all this stuff. But that's not the point. So talk about why that doesn't work and what the curriculum you've come up with that actually helps.
Well, like kids in Baltimore, they're supposed to write essays on the person who was lynched in Baltimore, 14, and in that same city in 1868, when 1,000 blacks were fired from the docks of Baltimore, they formed their own railroad, the Chesapeake, Maine Dry Dock and Railroad Company, that successfully operated between Baltimore and Maine and hired 1,000 people, including whites. How many of our children who are giving assignments to write about someone being lynched, how many even know that we own the railroad?
Right.
And so, and there are other examples of people who have achieved under those circumstances. We closed the education gap between 1920 and 1940 in the South.
Right.
It was eighth grade for whites, fifth grade for blacks. But because of the Rosenwald Booker T schools, that education gap was closed within 6 months in 20 years. And I asked Hawk Newman, if we were able to close the education gap during segregation in the South, would you use textbooks, half the budgets that we do today with a higher expenditure in these schools? And so I think it's important that experience will always, I think, trump an argument. So we must present experiences to challenge the arguments of the other side, not a counter argument. And that's why through our essays, we're trying to, the very fact that 75% of all slave families after slavery had a man and a woman raising children. And for 100 years, the nuclear family remained strong. In the 1930s and 1940s, the black family, we have the highest marriage rate of any group in society, the highest marriage rate. We need to celebrate that. We need, our kids need to know that we have the highest marriage rate.
Right.
And it was our Christian faith that kept us safe.
Yep. Yep. Will, what were
you
middle
class
that?
Was never defined by income. It was defined by behavior. The most middle class person in my neighborhood was Mr. Jackson, who came to his barbershop every day in a three-piece suit, and he was the superintendent of the Sunday school.
Hmm. Wow.
That's middle class.
Right. Right. Will, what are your thoughts on how we get people to see the positive in Black history.
Well, I mean, I think an important, I think you get people to see the positive in Black history by talking about it. I mean, I think an important point both of you guys have made during the last two segments is that problems have solutions, and it's important to talk about those solutions, which are often very practical. I mean, when you talk about the Golden 13, these skilled Black naval officers in the past, the reason that they performed so well was that they cram studied tough material for a long period of time. Then they went out and did well in the military. Right. I mean, so like one of the things that I really think, and this is something that I noticed a long time ago as a kid in a tough neighborhood, is that most stuff is not that complicated. If you want to avoid getting bullied, be funny or learn to fight. You know, if you want to have some success with women, be pleasant and learn to talk. You know, if you want to be passable at athletics, practice a lot. And this goes on into day-to-day life. If you want to stop crime, arrest criminals. Right. You know, you want to seal the border. You don't want to abuse people from a friendly nation like Mexico. But just put up a fence. Put a guy behind it with a gun. Say, no, you have to go back. In Spanish. That's it. You know, so I mean, like, the overcomplication of simple problems tends to be a sign of pseudo-intellectualism, and it's a way that people try to complicate and confuse things to distract taxpayers from the obvious. That's my opinion on all of this. What's the issue in the Black community? I mean, there are a few basic things. First of all, a lot of these issues exist in the white community as well. I mean, the idea that Black people have some spectacular, unprecedented level of failure in the U.S., I mean, would come as a real surprise in a trailer park or an Indian reservation. It's just no one really talks about that because that doesn't fit anyone's narrative. No one wants to give poor whites a lot of money. You know, but I mean, what are the problems in the Black community? You know, fatherlessness, crime, education. What do you do about that? You bring in high IQ teachers, you lengthen the school day. I mean, go to any New York charter, you'll see how to do it. So I thought that was a good summary from you guys of what to do there. In terms of what to teach during Black History Month, yeah, I don't see any reason not to teach stories of success. I think that if I had to give an opinion on this, the reason people don't is that they don't know them. Mm-hmm. Most of the teachers, and this includes the Black teachers as well, have never heard these stories. And this is a problem with multiculturalism in general, which is why I'm against it. Most people don't know anything at any depth about other cultures. Right. So when you take your average teacher, I mean, it's a nice person, but it's a 35-year-old middle-class woman, usually Caucasian, bachelor's degree, 990 SAT. They're perfectly qualified to teach math to sixth graders, which is what they signed up for. But when you start talking about like teaching Chinese culture alongside American culture, it's a tough job. Like I probably couldn't do that. I don't know if any of us could do that. So when you're making that a goal in the schools, like explain female sexuality to the students or something like that, you're setting people up for a weird kind of failure. Mm-hmm. And you're encouraging teachers just to pass along their personal half-assed political opinions.
Right.
And that's what you get a lot of. So like multiculturalism in general doesn't mean like an actual discussion of like how Ethiopia and Mali were as civilized as Rome, if you want to talk about Africa. It means like a lot of left-wing propaganda from the modern Western world being taught, like I, Rigoberta Menchu, that we had to read in school. So anyway, blah, blah, blah. I mean, during Black History Month, yeah, I'd love to teach some more of those stories. You know, there's not a Black-owned railroad today, which is amazing, right. You know, but you have to get teachers that know them.
Yeah. We had capital assets that we owned all over the country, in every city. In the Bronzeville section of Chicago in 1919, we have 730 Black-owned businesses, $100 million in real estate, $100 million in real estate assets.
When they don't have that now.
We didn't borrow that money from the bank.
Mr. Williams said when the country was 10% Black and segregated, something like 8% of the assets were Black-owned assets, just because that's logically what you'd expect. Like right. There was a difference in wealth. But you have two separate groups and neither one's going to live outside.
Somebody's got to service them, right?
So you have this massive, I mean, you had barbershops, beauty salons, restaurants, but beyond that, banks, livery companies, all that stuff. And basically, Black clientele kind of abandoned that after desegregation.
Yeah,
and
yeah, that was kind of apart. Ancillary. Yeah.
You don't want to say something like white man bought it or it went bankrupt, but that's what happened.
You should put it in the Royal Theater. I grew up in Philadelphia. In 1909, there was this grand theater built called the Royal Theater that was Black-owned. That's where I saw Lionel Hampton and all of the great jazz. It was a Black run with an orchestra pit.
Wow. Can we end on the new book? Can you talk about the new book and when it comes out? And
Yeah, we are. It's going to be called, I think, A Pathway to Pathway for America Renewal, and it's going to be red, white, and black. Volume two. It's going to be a series of essays, parables that will demonstrate by action the importance of these values that we call American values.
Yeah, all the important things that you can't say, like self-sufficiency and resilience and those kind of things. We need to get back to that. Well, it's been a great hour. It's been great having you on. And I think people are going to learn a lot from having you listening to what you think and what you want to say and all the knowledge that you have about Black history. He is Bob Woodson, founder of the Woodson Center and 1776 Unites. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Saving the day from you commies who let know you can't fuck with me. I got a country to save. God bless the US of A. Land of the free and a home of the brave. God get all of the praise. I got a country to save, cause I'm Patriot J and I'm saving the day.